Let's go, Spence. We are back. Ventura Forward, the 805 podcast, bringing you, you know, the tasty waves, the good tunes, and the local grub, and the conversation that our community always wants to hear. We know we're bringing those vibes and the goods, and we're here today with John Barrick. This gentleman is putting his name in the hat to be a district attorney for Ventura County, and we brought John in today to find out what are some of the little differences between his candidacy and some of the personal sides that makes him a professional for this job. John, how you doing today?
I'm great. How are you?
Hey, we're doing good. We're here today in studio bringing you in. Thank you for your time. I want to learn a little more about you. And so first off, let's talk about district attorney. What are you currently doing for a profession?
I'm a prosecutor. I've been a prosecutor for 17 and a half years, and I currently work in the homicide unit where I've been for 7 and a half.
Excellent. And that's all in Ventura County?
Oh, yes. 17 and a half years in Ventura County. I applied straight out of law school. The only place I actually wanted to be a prosecutor in the end was Ventura County, so it was the only place I applied. I wouldn't advise that as career advice to only apply to one job out of school, but it's where I really wanted to work, and fortunately I got the job.
That determination brought you to the beautiful county of Ventura.
Well, I'm from here. I grew up in Oxnard.
You're Northridge. That's right. Let's start with that. You went to quite a few schools. You had a very interesting path from New York, Staten Island, and you came over here. There was a divorce in the family, so you had somewhat of disrupted youth. But it seemed like you had according to the website, and I've been reading off BarrickForDA.com, you had a pretty tight-knit family, though, as far as the extended portion of your family when you got here.
Well, tight-knit is an odd word. So I was born in Staten Island, New York, but I was 9 weeks old when my mother moved out here. My father was in the Marines, and he got actually stationed out in L.A., so that's why we came out. We lived in the Downey-Norwalk area until I was about eight. My folks divorced, and my mom remarried my stepfather, and he got a job up in Santa Barbara. Well, we couldn't afford to live in Santa Barbara, so we moved to Oxnard when I was 8 years old. And It was a rough upbringing. We didn't have a lot of money. There were alcohol and substance abuse issues. And I mean, to be quite frank, I hated my house. I hated living there. So it was a hard time because my parents had problems keeping jobs. We moved around a lot. So when I first got to Oxnard, I went to Harrington Elementary School, and then I ended up at Elm Street, which is where I graduated from sixth grade. They didn't have graduation ceremonies back then like they did now. They just said, get out, you know. And then I went to Haydock for a semester, and then we moved again. So I ended up at E.O. Green, and E.O. Green is where I graduated from. And then right before I was supposed to start school at Wainimi High, we moved again, and that's how I ended up at Oxnard High School. And fortunately, I was there for the 4 years because I really hated moving around and changing schools.
Especially at that age, too. So let's remove tight-knit, but bring it into that. I didn't know about the abuse of alcohol
yes.
and substances like that. So when it came to your life as you aged out, seeing that in the world and now being in law enforcement and being with the district attorney, how does that make you look at issues like homeless, like crime, when drugs and alcohol are involved, does it make you more strict because it impacted you in such a negative way? Or do you actually have some empathy for some of these people? It must be an odd position to be raised through that and now prosecute some of it.
It actually makes me feel both. At times it makes me want to be a little more harsh or a little more strict with sentences, but at the same time, I do have empathy. I can tell you I don't have a lot of sympathy. Having lived through the abuse issues and seeing the poor choices my parents would make over and over again, it was very frustrating for someone living in the house, seeing them make these choices and they would make, how do I say this? When you're an addict of any type, you're a very selfish person by nature, right? Because your addiction, whatever that is more important than anything else. So I understand the addict in the sense that they are inherently selfish because of their disease, which it is. It is a disease, and that's where the empathy comes from. Because once you get hooked on these substances, it's very, very difficult to get off of them. However, addicts will leave a trail of damage and destruction that's very hard to mend if you don't make the effort. And, you know, my parents just never really made that effort.
And I think, John, you're hitting right into where we're going to about these people in our community in the 805 are the ones creating most of the crime. We talk about the unsheltered, unhoused individuals. We also call them homeless. We talk about the drug addiction. We know now with over 500 or 600 homeless people in the city of Ventura alone that this is the number one topic on people's minds. There's no doubt about it. It might have been money before or some of the situation, but now it's safety and the comfortability of living in this great county. And so the question the voters have been asking me, and I would love to have your take on this, is how can we make a difference, right? If Totten has been the district attorney, Mr. Nazarenko has been here for a year and a half. We see crime getting worse, it feels like, every single day. What can you do as a new district attorney for Ventura County to make a real difference right away?
Well, one of the things I want to do is put a reemphasis on supporting crime victims. Because of laws that have been passed in Sacramento and some of the policies that have been put in place, I feel as a prosecutor, we've lost our focus. See, as prosecutors, we're really the last line of defense for crime victims. And so the laws in Sacramento that have passed and everything that has come from that, we tend to worry more about the criminals. You know, it's I say sometimes, you know, the state of California asks two questions of a criminal. Number one, who did you hurt? Number two, how can we help you? And that's not really what it should be. It should be, you know, I'll protect your constitutional rights, but I'm going to focus on preserving the dignity and getting justice for the crime victims. And we've really lost our focus now. It's like, because of the way we do things, because of that lack of focus, that crime victims are being re-victimized all over again. And so as I would like to see in the community, you know, I want to put a re-emphasis on crime victims, and I want to put a re-emphasis on getting justice for them. You know, I don't want to hear about programs and diversion and things of that nature that a lot of people are getting now in lieu of accountability, because it doesn't teach accountability. It doesn't hold anyone accountable. And the way the diversion, these programs are supposed to work is you get diversion, and if you stay good for 6 months, in other words, you don't pick up another case, your case gets dismissed as if it never happened. But what we're seeing happening is that people will pick up multiple cases and they're still getting diversion because, you know, it's just an easier method of disposing of the case. And my whole thing is, well, they get one shot at it, which I don't think they should at all anyway, but they get one shot at it. If they blow it, well, then let's proceed.
And correct me if I'm wrong here, because from a community member, it seems like if the more you do or the more mentally unstable you are in the streets, the more mulligans you're getting, the more get out of jail free passes, this more, it doesn't make sense to me as a person. The more crime you do, no matter what your mental state is, you should be prosecuted more. But it seems like this district attorney and the county and different things has found ways to give criminals ways out from their prior punishments. Am I wrong with that? Or is that kind of the sentiment that's going on right now?
No, that is definitely the perception that's going on. You know, it's a really fine line, though, because, I mean, the community has really spoken, you know, people with substance abuse issues, people with mental health issues, we don't want to see them in jail. And because the jail facilities just don't have the capabilities of providing the help and the resources these people would need to re-enter society successfully. But we can't have them living on our beaches and in front of our houses and down the street and in river bottoms and things of that nature, because those areas are inherently dangerous. I don't know if you've ever walked the river bottom, but it's a dangerous place. It really is. I mean, assaults and violent acts happen there all the time. A lot of it doesn't get reported to the police because, you know, it's like its own little world down there. And those things, when a community sees these things in their area, it makes them feel unsafe.
Yeah.
And the population, as you noted, it's just growing. And so we don't want to put people with mental health issues and substance abuse issues in jail, but we can't keep them where they are. So what do we do?
Well, what we're doing right now is doing this Project Room Key, right? Our turnkey project where we have vouchers all over the county where these people are living in our hotels, our motels. The Vagabond we know got turned into this. These are programs that I've spotted an overwhelming majority of the people do not want them in our community because they're taking away rooms that could be rented by tourists who could be paying money. These same criminals are then bringing in people from the river bottoms into these rooms and creating a system of problems. So I love that you're aware of what's going on. And can you maybe touch on real quick quickly about the room key and also the home key, because I know for a fact that the county is keeping a proposal of turning the La Quinta Inn on South Victoria by the 101 freeway into a permanent housing facility with over 120 beds. And I don't know anybody in our community who wants to offer that as a permanent solution, because we see what happens when you have houses next to the railroad track and close to the river bottom. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I'm not a fan of giving housing to homeless people, and because I think it sends the wrong message. We have communities of people who aren't homeless, who work really hard. They're not, you know, who have problems making ends meet because with inflation, everything going sky high, and they're really struggling to hang on, and nobody helps them. But if you don't have a house, and if you have a drug problem, then the government just wants to throw money at you and give you a free room somewhere. And it sends the wrong message, I yep. think. If you're a responsible person doing your best to be a productive member of society, we're not going to help you. But if you're homeless and have substance use problems, then here's a key to an apartment, you know, or to a hotel room or something like that. And I think that sends the wrong message. I don't think it's the answer. Again, jail isn't the answer. All right, we can't just lock people up because they're homeless or they have drug problems. But we have to find a solution that's actually going to last. It seems to me these turnkey solutions are just a quick fix, you know, to just, well, we'll just get them off the street so it doesn't look so bad. Well, that's nice, but it doesn't solve the problem. And that's, I think, what citizens are really wanting from their political leaders now is, like, stop doing the quick fixes. Give us real solutions. And my whole point is there are people in the community who work with the homeless, who care for the homeless, the mentally ill, the people with substance use issues, and they have good ideas. I don't know what they are, but I would love to hear them and implement them. We can't put them in jail, but they can't stay where they are. So let's talk to the people who work in these areas, who've spent their lives and dedicated their lives to homelessness, and hear their solutions and start implementing some of them, like real solutions to homelessness instead of just quick fixes.
And one of the issues that we have, and what Spencer was hitting that I've always been amazed on in what you talked about, John, is the fact that we give people too much. Because with anything, and we know this from children to, you know, students in school, if you don't make them do something and just give them something, there's no point. So if you just give your kid an allowance and he's not doing chores, it's like, hey, this is cool. I keep getting, if there's a pipeline, but no demand of some sort of work by the person. So when you enter these houses, be sober. When you enter these houses, maybe get into a 12-step program. If you enter these houses, start getting a job. I've worked with a lot of people in this community. Jim Duran is one of the great ones, where there is buy-in to a project. So if we look from the ground floor where the police officers are working and they arrest people, I'm looking at your website again here, Crime Victims Come First. It's got to be just really, really frustrating for the police officers too. It's like a catch and release program, like it's mm-hmm. Fish or something. You know, I've arrested this guy 5 times in the last amount of time. Why does he keep getting out? So to keep people in jail or prison is important. But on the other side, and not to be too soft about it, if we don't retrain them while they're in there, they'll just come out more angry that they lost due to their fault. They did commit a crime. But what can we do once you prosecute? And I know this isn't your job, but it is a cycle. It's the police officers making the arrest. It's the DA making the prosecution, so they go to jail. But once they get in jail, do you see something that we can do for the people in jail so they don't become repeat offenders?
Yes. That's actually what I would like to see is, right now, the laws want prosecutors to serve as social workers and provide all these services to criminals, in lieu of punishment to help them out. I'm like, well, that's not my role. That's not my lane. When it comes in the criminal justice field, my lane isn't to assist criminals. It's to defend crime victims. All right. Criminals have their, you know, have their defense attorney, and there are advocates out there for them. And so that's their job. My job isn't to be an advocate for for those accused of crime. As a society, we need to take a two-prong approach, really be more proactive on the front end. In other words, identify those groups of people or communities that are more susceptible to crime or committing crime and start getting them the services and the help they need proactively so that they don't ever enter the criminal justice system. And then, you know, while I'm a huge believer in accountability, I'm also a huge believer in not continuing to punish people after they've served their sentence, whatever that may be. And that is something we really have a problem with in this country, is somebody picks up a crime, they get a rap sheet. This is a sheet that goes around. It's nationwide, really. And it's your criminal record. And we continue to punish people because that record follows them wherever they go. And there's many crimes where, you know, maybe they committed crimes when they were younger, and but they got their life together. But they can't ever really succeed in life because when they were 18 or 19, they did a robbery.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but here they are, they're in their 40s or 50s, and they've really lived a good life, but they can never get that promotion. So in other words, we continue to punish that person for something they did when they were 18, 19, 20, whatever it was. And so on the back end, once someone has been sentenced, whatever that sentence is, that's where you introduce the programs to re-enter them back into society. For the people that proactively we weren't able to help, let's help them once they get their sentence, they're serving their sentence, whatever that may be, let's help them then. Let's provide them all the programs that they need. That way, when they re-enter into society, they'll have the tools they need, hopefully, to not re-offend. And that's something we don't do. In fact, little people don't know this. Do you know what the average amount of money that the state of California spends on an inmate once they've been released from prison? Any guess?
$125,000.
$200.
$200.
$200. They give them $200 and send them on their way. And then we wonder why.
So it's not a new suit. The cliche in the old days was you walk with a new suit. Now they give you $200 and hopefully things are going to work out for you.
Right. And so my whole theory as to why they pass all these laws to force prosecutors to do stuff is because politicians are self-serving by nature, right? And so they don't want to do anything unless they're going to get the credit for it, because they can't run for their next office or re-election on something they did that's going to take 20 or 30 years before we see some real results, right? And so they run on headlines. So they pass some immediate legislation, which probably won't work, but they don't care because then they can say, look what I'm doing to solve this problem. Look what I did to solve this problem. Vote for me. And people go, great, I'm going to vote for them. Look what they're doing. Because they don't care if it actually works. See, what I'm suggesting, the proactive approach and then programs for people once they've been sentenced, whatever that sentence may be, would take time, effort, and money. It would likely take a generation, maybe even two generations, before we really started seeing the results of these programs. But some politician who makes the rules today can't take credit for it when it goes well 20 years from now. And a politician looks at that and they say, well, I'm not going to do something here. Some guy or some politician 20 years from now can take the credit for the stuff that I did then. So let's not do that. Let's do something quick and easy so I can get the credit. And that is something, as a society, not just local races, but nationwide and statewide for sure, where we really need to change. Like, let's get real solutions. Let's figure out how we're going to actually solve these problems instead of constantly looking for the quick fix.
It's big scissors, a ribbon, balloons.
Right.
But then what happens?
Exactly. Headlines. Look what look at me. Look what I'm doing. There's a headline. And they can run on it. They can put it on a flyer. And then off they go. But it doesn't actually solve anything.
How do you convince the voting public, though, that, folks, this is going to take time. I'm on a mission here to really create something and to get the message that you just put forth across. I think people do want, just like whatever we are, weight loss, whatever we do, we want that magical thing to happen to us. So I love the agenda and I love the determination, but to tell people that, you're being straight up saying this is going to take a little time, but we've got to stay the course.
I think if you're just honest with people, I mean, people are just aching for honesty. They just want their leaders to be honest and straight with them, even if it's bad news. Just be straight with them. We've gotten into this rut of nobody wants to admit when they made a mistake, and nobody wants to tell anyone the truth, even if it's bad news.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, it really discredits the citizens of our county and certainly of our country when politicians constantly, take that approach. So for me, I talk a lot about transparency and openness. Well, it's easy because my guiding principle has always been victims come first. Everything I do will be designed toward putting victims first, not putting myself first, not putting any of my beliefs first, just what's best for crime victims. What do I need to do to best serve the community? Because that's what I've done for 17 and a half years.
I'm really enjoying where this conversation is going here with John Barrick, a candidate for Ventura County District Attorney. We got to take a quick minute here to give a shout out to our sponsors, of course, for making this podcast happen. We got the Ventura Music Hall playing that new venue on Thompson Boulevard, the Ventura Real Estate Company, and Pizza Man Dan. Thank you so much for your benefits of giving back to Ventura Ford. And two of our seven sponsors this last month are Mr. Mountain Doll and the M&M Public Safety. So if you're looking for a sponsor of the podcast and continue these great conversations, please reach out to us and we can gladly get that done as well. Moving forward here with DA John Barrick, we're going to change the tune a little bit and go for a couple of lighter questions. Spence, is that okay with you?
Let's do it, because I know Mr. Barrick likes baseball.
Let's go with our first baseball one then. You say you're a Dodger fan, right, sir?
Yeah, I've been a Dodger fan since 1976. My parents took me to my first Dodger game. It was a Giants game, and the Dodgers won.
Nice. All right, with this tough question then, with one name and one name only, who is your favorite Dodger of all time?
Steve Garvey. Loved Steve Garvey.
What number did Garvey wear?
6. One of my favorite numbers.
Okay. Thank you for that one question. What'd you have for dinner last night?
I had some leftover roast chicken, some roasted vegetables, and some rolls. I think 2 or 3 rolls.
Okay, excellent. When choosing an exercise to burn off some of these calories that we intake every day, what's your recreation of choice?
Well, I go to the gym. Does that count, or do you mean something
else? If you go to the gym, so maybe give me a few of the exercises that you do at the gym that you prefer.
I enjoy the Stairmaster, the elliptical, and then a little bit of the treadmill.
Cardio?
Yes.
You're going to hit more cardio than the weights.
Yeah, and I've been told not to do that. I've been told that you have to hit the weights more. So when the election is over, I've got some friends who lift weights.
How much of this is stress-related? How much is this a goal? Because you are in a job that's, I'm guessing, I'm speaking for you here, that's fairly stressful. Is a lot of this just like, I want to look good when I'm out on the beach, or, man, I got to burn off some of this energy because this job is very demanding mentally?
It's more about stress relief and keeping down my weight. So actually, I lost 65 pounds.
Hello.
Good for you. 2020. During COVID, when everyone was gaining weight, I actually lost 65 pounds in 5 months.
I got about 30 of yours.
I've always struggled with my weight. And so, and I wanted to be thinner when I was 50, right? Because you start worrying about your health more when you're 50. And the reality is you can't be close to 300 pounds, which is what I was, when you're 50 years old. And unfortunately, when I turned 50, I didn't lose the weight that I wanted, and I was very frustrated myself. So I decided, and I turned 50 in 2019. So if you're doing the math, yes, I'm 52. I'll be 53 next month. And I know as you get older, it gets harder and harder to lose weight. And so I said, look, I've got to get my health in gear because you don't want to be older and be 300 pounds when you can't walk anymore. You know,
sure.
Because your body just can't maintain that kind of weight for very long.
No, congratulations on losing that weight too.
Thank you.
Tell us more about your personal side. I appreciate that. We talked about you growing up in Staten Island. You moved to the 805 as a young man. In that development in your high school, in your college years, in the film and stuff at CSUN. But I want to know about your prosecution and your love to be in the courtroom. When did that develop, and when did that fuel to be involved in the courtroom exist and get created?
I didn't come out of high school. I didn't even come out of college with the idea of being a lawyer. I went into college with a haphazard idea that I wanted to be a film production major. The only thing I knew when I graduated from college was that I did not want to work in film production. But I didn't know what I wanted to do. But I had taken a class at CSUN. Now, when you're an RTVF major, which stands for Radio, Television, Film, and depending, when you're that major, and then you have an emphasis on either radio, television, or film, everyone has to take this class. And I actually think it was called RTVF 360 at the time. And the class was called FCC Rules and Regulations. So the FCC stands for Federal Communications Commission, which is the governing body that sets down the policies and rules for any broadcast medium like radio, for example. And everyone said, you know, this class is terrible. You don't want to take this class. But if you have to, definitely don't take it with Professor Johnson because he's very difficult. Well, unfortunately, when I took the class, the only class that fit within my schedule was with Professor Johnson.
Was his first name Emery?
I don't remember his first name.
We had the same. I was there 10 years before, and Emery, it had to be the same guy.
It had to be.
And we echoed 10 years
crazy.
Later. I was told the same thing.
Yeah, it has to be the same guy. That is crazy.
But a brilliant class, and I'm in full agreement.
No, he was brilliant. Mm-hmm. Don't get me wrong, but he just, you have to remember, like, I'm
You don't have to worry
production.
About the FCC if you want to use a bad word because this is a podcast.
Yeah,
I know just, who he was.
No, yeah. Film production majors, they're all like loosey-goosey artists. Yeah. So anything to deal with rules and regulations, they just hated. But I loved it. I just loved the class. Like, I would read ahead because I couldn't wait to read what's next week's lesson's going to be or whatever. I mean, it was ridiculous. And mind you, I've never been an academic. I'm a good student. I'm not a great student. I never enjoyed the classroom. So for me, this was a real, I was like, where did this come from? And it was actually the only class in undergrad where I got the A+.
Wow. Good for you.
And in fact, he, if you remember, he graded on a curve. Mm-hmm. And he actually told me towards the end of the semester that he had to alter the curve, because if he based everyone's grades on my test scores, which was the peak of the curve, he goes, he'd have to fail half the class because I was getting legitimate A's. See, normally in his class, it gets legitimate. You know, the A's were like the low B's. Like, people would get 80, 81%. I was getting legitimate, like, 94, 95s on my tests. And so he had to actually lower the curve, and so he didn't have to fail the class. So that was really the first time when I realized, hey, you know, this whole rules and regulations and how it affects people, that's really interesting to me. I don't know why.
And how much more schooling after that? Because I hear lawyers, you always hear reading, studying. Like, and I like this idea that you grew into it. You're not calling yourself a scholar or an academic, but your passion for the law and the rules overtook that. And explain a little more of your schooling after that.
Yeah, so law school is awful. It's an awful experience, but it's a means to an end. I don't regret it. Just understand it is 3 brutal years. There's a lot to learn and a lot to memorize. But when I graduated from Cal State Northridge in the fall of 1991, I would have put my hand on a Bible and swore to you I was never going back to school again. I actually celebrated that graduation as, I am done with school. I'm forever done. I'm so done with school, this is going to be awesome. And I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life, but I knew it didn't involve going back to school. And so even with that FCC regulation class experience, I was like, I'm not going back. I just don't want to go. And so I got a job in closed captioning, which is when you type the words on the screen for the hearing impaired so they can watch television.
Sure.
And movies. I actually closed captioned Star Wars when they were doing the re-releases, when they started coming out with DVDs and stuff like that.
Oh, that had to That's be
right.
fun.
That's a part of history right here. Also, here's a little piece of history for you. Do you guys remember that Jeopardy champion, Ken Jennings?
Sure.
Yeah. I captioned the episode where he last won and the episode where he lost right here. Television history. Yeah, that's right.
And it was a woman from Ventura County.
Yes, that's right. And by the way, no doubt in my mind, he threw it. He threw the match because the question was about Bastille, right? The Battle French. Of the Bulge, the town, you know. Yeah. And so there was no way he would miss the Battle of the Bulge question. I mean, there's no way. And he just threw it. Well, when I looked at the broadcast schedule, I noted that that particular episode, because they film everything in advance, was going to air on the last day of sweeps. Well, sweeps, if people don't know, sweeps are there's 4 months in a year when networks judge their ratings, so that and they set their advertising rates based on those ratings. So November is one of the big sweep months. I think May and November are the big sweep months of the year. So when I saw that episode was going to be airing on November 30th, I was like, oh, there it is. Like, he waited until the end of sweeps before he threw it.
And oddly enough, the great movie Quiz Show, when he was cheating, though, but he actually kind of threw the relief when he lost. And you wonder if Jennings said, I got to get out of this, because at that point, he's probably getting mad offers.
Right.
That's an interesting take. We'll have to look further into that. Pop quiz, 1972 World Series. Who won?
Oakland A's. They beat the Pirates. And I think, how many games did it take? I think 5 or 6 games. I honestly don't remember how many games it was, but it was the A's.
It was the A's over the Pirates.
A's over the Pirates in 72.
I want to move over to drugs and that issue as we wrap up this wonderful podcast here and talk about the DA's involvement in that. We had a story earlier this week about a San Diego task force and this tunnel that was like a quarter mile long, built by drug runners who are clearly professional and moneyed enough to create something that Caltrans would be happy with. I mean, these are rail tunnels. They've got air conditioning. They've got, you know, obviously breathable air. This level of sophistication to get drugs in this country is a huge deal. The drug problem as you see it, is it a user issue? Is it a supply issue? How do you, as a prosecutor, as district attorney, what would you do to fight this horrific problem we have now?
Well, we have to start putting pressure on the politicians in Sacramento. So as a prosecutor, as the district attorney, I'm sworn to uphold the law. Even if I don't like the law or don't agree with it, I have to uphold it. Well, the state of California over the last 10, 11 years has basically decriminalized drugs. We can't put drug dealers in prison anymore. I don't know if people know that. I don't think they do. And drug users themselves, the crimes are so minimal. We don't a lot of times we don't even bother to criminally charge them anymore. And so we need to at least, you know, I understand there's people don't want to punish drug users because we see the substance abuse as a disease. But what about the drug dealers? You can't decriminalize both. If you decriminalize drug dealers, well, all it's going to do is embolden drug dealers to do more drug dealing. You know, they're going to get a slap on the wrist and they're going to come back into the community. Well, they're just the people with the substance abuse problems. They're just easy prey for the drug dealers. So all you're doing is allowing for the drug dealers more opportunity to sell their drugs to their clientele, which are the drug users. And then at the same time, the state of California is allowing for free injection sites and free needles, and now they're giving away free meth pipes. But society, we want people off drugs. And we want them to go into programs. Well, as someone who's experienced, you know, firsthand, people with substance abuse issues, you cannot just ask people to seek help. You have to force them. You see, and so while nobody wants to see drug users in jail, one of the things that we could do is tell them, we'll either put you in jail for 90 days or you go into a drug treatment program. And a lot of times they take the drug treatment program. And largely, it was pretty unsuccessful. But there were some success stories where people who took advantage of that situation and were able to get their lives back together. We don't have that anymore. So we want people to get programs, but this Sacramento has given us no ability whatsoever to provide those programs to people or to put them in a position to succeed. If anything, all we're doing is we're giving drug users the tools they need to continue their substance abuse. So what we need to do is, number one, the public needs to be alerted to these things. And this is one of the things I talk about is as district attorney, I need to use my office as a microphone to alert to people to some of the laws and things that are happening. That was actually one of the reasons why I decided to run for DA, is that laws were being passed in Sacramento, and I wouldn't find out about them until December when I'd get this email at the end of the year saying, oh, here's all the new laws you need to know. And some of these laws, I'm like, what is going on? Like, how is it, number one, that this was even considered? But number two, how is it I didn't know about it? Like, there are organizations in the criminal justice field that should be sending out blasts, that should be sending out emails like, here are the laws that they're considering, and we need to unite. We need to work together. We need to do something to stop this. And just nobody does anything. And politicians only respond to pressure. Well, if nobody's putting pressure on them to do what's right for crime victims or to do what's right for law-abiding citizens, then they're not going to do it. That's just the nature of the career politician, right? Because they're more interested in serving their personal agendas than they are in serving the public, in my opinion. So I have to use my office to put pressure on them, and I have to get them to change the law somehow from Ventura County, and maybe I can unite other counties as well who are just as interested. But something has to be done. We can't keep continuing down this road that we are on. And so when you read about tunnels and things like that, well, it makes sense. You know, I mean, I don't think those tunnels were in California, but in the state of California, we've basically decriminalized drug use and drug sales. So how are we supposed to fight the problem if you don't give us the tools or the teeth in the law that we need to fight these problems?
So this sounds like another one of your long terms. You're not just there to cut the ribbon and say it's going to happen today. This is a process that has to go through legislation to make the law. See, I thought you could prosecute into rehab. I thought you could charge and make it part of the sentence.
We used to be able to.
You cannot now.
No.
Didn't know that.
No. Well, because let's say I get busted with, you know, some methamphetamine on me. Well, they take me to jail. I immediately get released now because of the no cash bail rules that have come out. And then, so I serve, what, 20, 30 minutes, however long for the car ride over to the jail. So they release me. And then even if we filed the case, I would get now, because it's a misdemeanor, something called judicial diversion, which is, as long as I don't pick up any new cases for 6 months, that case goes away like it was nothing. But even if I do pick up another drug possession case, the reality is the judge is probably going to offer judicial diversion again because nobody cares. Nobody cares about the drug use problems anymore because the message from Sacramento has been very clear. we don't want to punish people with drug problems anymore.
So are we saying basically that if you do care about drug problems, you want to stop drugs in our society, we need to make that our number one priority when voting, right? Because you've mentioned the word that no one cares, but to my understanding, everyone cares. And I think that you do, I know what you're saying, feels like they don't care because we're not having those laws brought down from Sacramento. But I would say that an overwhelming majority of the public in the Ventura County doesn't want to support politicians. And you brought that word up a few times. Do you feel like yourself that you're a politician?
No, I don't feel like I'm a politician. So career, you know, this is the first office I've ever run for. I never had any desire to run for office ever. I never spent a career like making political connections in case I ever wanted to do something. You know, I prosecuted my homicides and I would play fantasy football. I mean, that was basically my life. You know, my wife and I love to travel. You know, I like to hang out with my family. I mean, that was my life. I didn't get involved in politics at all. But I'd seen some of the things happening in the state over the years that were really frustrating. Number one, Sacramento passing laws that gutted crime victims' rights. Number two, the fact that people didn't know about them. Number three, I didn't like the way law enforcement was being treated. You know, it seemed to me that now in the state that the criminals were being treated like they were the victims and law enforcement was being treated like they were the criminals. And no public officials would stand up or with them, which drove me crazy. And then lastly, I got tired of self-serving career politicians making decisions about your public safety based on just what would be best for them. And so when Greg Totten announced his retirement rather suddenly in November of 2020, there were people putting their names in for the job. And I looked at those names coming in and I thought, well, none of those people are going to do the job that I think needs should be done. And so I saw, at that point in my life, I saw I had two choices. Number one, I could stay in my office and prosecute my cases and complain to no one in particular. Now, mind you, I love my job. I have a great office. I love my cases. You know, so that would have been fine. But nothing would have been fixed. And so my option number two was I could get out of my chair, put my money where my mouth is, and just do something. And so I decided on the latter option. And so that's why I decided to run.
Our podcast today is going a little bit longer than later, but this John Barrick interview, I could keep going and going, Spence. I'm hearing this. Just, it's such a need for our community to understand who's going to be prosecuting and taking over that district attorney's office moving forward. I'm going to have one more question, Spence. You got one more for me? What are you at?
I have a lightweight softball question because we know, along with baseball, football is enjoyed by Mr. Barrick.
It is. But I'm going to get back into it, though, because I'm the one who, I guess, is burning on this because I'm just passionate. You know, my.
Can I say one thing, by the way?
Sure.
The baseball question a moment ago, I think I was wrong. It was the A's beat the Reds because the Pirates won in 71. So I think the A's beat
the Reds. Was that the We Are Family year when they were singing that?
No, that was 79.
Yeah. Okay,
the
79
Pirates,
was
the
We
Pirates
Are
Family. The We Are Family year.
Okay. Pirates book ended.
Stargell
yeah.
Stars and all
yeah,
that.
Pirates yeah, Pirates won in 71 and 79. And I think the A's did win in 72, but they beat the Reds. They did not beat the Pirates. It was driving me crazy. I was like, gosh darn it.
Because they won 3 years in a row. In 72,
73, 74. See, 73, they beat the Mets in 7, and in 74, they beat the Dodgers
yeah,
in 5.
So I remember the Dodgers series vividly.
Yeah.
Getting
Steve
back
Garvey's MVP year, I want to point out.
Prosecution is the word I've heard you saying over and over. And probably the big difference maybe between you and Mr. Nazarenko when it comes to being tougher on crime and prosecution. That's what I'm hearing in that sense. I want to talk to you about a very specific thing that happened in the last few months here in the city of Ventura, where five city council members went to Washington, D.C. at direction of city manager Alex McIntyre, and there was a clear Brown Act violation of a quorum going and having a meeting, talking about city business without it being on the agenda. We've now heard from the current district attorney's office that they're not going to be looking into this violation and prosecuting. My question is this, why don't Brown Act violations get prosecuted, and would you as a district attorney have prosecuted this violation?
Well, I don't know if I would have prosecuted this violation because I don't know anything about it. I okay, mean, I all I know is what I've read in the paper. I'm not privy to the information. I'm not privy to the facts and circumstances.
Sure.
So I can't say whether or not I would have prosecuted it. You know, as prosecutors, I can tell you, you know, just because there's a crime that's necessarily been broken doesn't mean we have to prosecute every single thing that happens. Sometimes my understanding is Brown Act violations occur unintentionally. They just screwed up. And so do we really want to start prosecuting every single Brown Act violation that ever happens just because of a simple misunderstanding or a mistake? Probably not. That's not good public policy. Now, I don't know if that was the situation here.
Sure.
But I can tell you that if there is a Brown Act violation, we don't prosecute it. That would be one of the main reasons, because it was unintentional. Now, I mean, I'm sure there's other ways where the city council members who violated can be punished, whether it be through some sort of censorship by their fellow city council members, or election. You know, the best way to, again, punish an elected official who does something you don't like is vote them out of office when their time comes. I mean, that's democracy. So those are the other avenues that we can take in order to punish people for Brown Act.
And you're totally right about that in the sense where you don't know the details, and I appreciate you taking that question that way, but more in this direct line of prosecution, because you can choose to prosecute some things as a district attorney and choose to prosecute not other things. And that's the biggest reason for this election, right? Do you feel like you'll be a stronger prosecutor than Mr. Nazarenko when it comes to fighting crime in the county of Ventura?
Yeah, I do, because again, the role of the prosecutor has to be on crime victims. Everything you do in the district attorney's office has to be dedicated to that. And to that end, I've identified two groups that need to be fully supported in order to effectuate better service to the community as well as more dedication to crime victims. Number one are our frontline DAs. Now, I can tell you, I mean, I know obviously all of the DAs in our office, and our county's really blessed. We have some fantastic prosecutors who are just aching to really serve the public. But I feel like in a lot of ways they're held back because they're not getting the support they would like to see from their management. Number two is law enforcement. You know, we at times have a very distant relationship with law enforcement, but and because of that disconnect that we have at times, we're not all able to be on the same page about how to best serve crime victims. And the role of the district attorney is to make sure that everyone gets on the same page. See, the way decisions work, or the flow works in our office right now, is management makes decisions and it's up to the rest of us to make them look good. So it's almost like it's a top down. And I think a lot of organizations have that. And I want to change that. You know, I can't serve crime victims if I'm asking my DAs to serve me individually. So what I want to do is change that flow from bottom up. You tell me what you need to best serve the community and I will get it for you. That's my job. That's how I see it. And it's also my job to go out into the community and I don't mean just city councils. I mean the actual community. I mean the people out there who are rolling up their sleeves and doing the real work, and go to them and say, what do you need to solve these problems? And I will do my best to get them for you, with all understanding that I'm putting crime victims first. Now, going back to something I said earlier, we don't want to prosecute people with substance use problems, and we don't want to prosecute the homeless. I mean, what I mean is put them in jail just for those reasons. But make no mistake, if you hurt someone, I will prosecute you. I don't care what your background is. I don't care how sorry your story is, because my job is to defend crime victims. And if you hurt someone and create a crime victim, I will prosecute you. I will prosecute you for whatever sentence that I feel is appropriate. And that's what the focus of the district attorney needs to be.
Working from the bottom up, you know, we had the opportunity of having current Sheriff Will A.U. been here along with the other candidate.
Did you say Will?
Bill.
I thought you said Will A.U.
I do sometimes still.
Will, yeah. I've never heard him call Will. That was funny to me.
When you're a Ventura Bulldog, sometimes the shorter names come out, I guess.
And we had Jim Fryhoff.
And we had Jim Fryhoff on there too. And one of these candidates talked about one works from the top down and one works from the bottom up. Are you at liberty to say that you're supporting one sheriff or another on this podcast for the upcoming election?
I did come out in support of Jim Fryhoff. I was at his press conference when he announced his candidacy. You know, to be completely frank with you, I love Bill A.U. I think he's great. I have no problems with him. And I hadn't met Bill until I started running for election several months later. I met Jim once, like a handshake several years ago. He didn't remember. You know, Jim Fryhoff is great too. They're both really great guys. But for me, you know, I've always seen myself as a frontline worker. I work in the trenches, right? That's what line deputies are. And so I had, when the majority of the deputies in the sheriff's department come to me and they say, we want a new boss, that was why I decided to support Jim Fryhoff in the end, because I support those guys. You know, and it didn't come easy. Because Sheriff Ayoub has a number of people in management who I'm very close with and I love. I mean, they're just, it's a very hard thing to say. It's not cut and dry. Sure. I can tell you, I did struggle with it because he has you know, a lot of guys in management as well that I just think are terrific. But in the end, when the majority of the deputies come to me and say, we want a new sheriff, I support them. I support the line deputies. And if they want a new boss, then that's what I want for them.
And it's an interesting point to make there. And I love it because one of the things we get, you have to dislike the opponent. And you don't.
No,
you
know, not
you
at
don't
all.
Have to.
I think Bill is great.
And I get a lot of that. We've interviewed both, and they're, I think, dedicated to their beliefs 100%.
Yeah, Jim is great, too. I mean, they're both great guys, and they're really dedicated to public service and serving crime victims. I mean, I really feel that way. I just, it wasn't easy, and I think a lot of people might feel the same way. But in the end, I support the line deputies, and if they want a new boss, then that's what I'm going to support.
Can we ask the final question? Football fan?
Yes.
Can the Rams repeat?
No. So the NFL is so tough. Everyone wants their team to be in a dynasty, and they just can't. You got to remember, there's 32 teams in the NFL, and they all want to win the Super Bowl, and they're all doing things to try to get there. And so you said can? Yes. The answer is can. Is it possible? Yes, it is. But I don't think they will.
Brady?
Tampa Bay.
Brady coming back? Is he
playing another year
to make money? But does he have a chance?
He has a chance. Tampa Bay's a good team. I don't think they're going to win either.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a lot of teams that have really improved.
I smell a butt kicking coming up. I really do. I think he's
for the
stayed
rant,
one
for
too long. No, for Brady. I think he stayed one too long.
What
the
heck
know. Do
Tampa
I know?
Bay,
I kind of
really
feel like the
team.
NFL has made laws like they have around homeless people for this state. You know, I mean, Brady is so old, they're going to protect him. You know what I mean? Like,
I gotta,
the more liable you get.
Flag, yeah, every time. Yeah.
You know, I got to tell you, though, Brady is great.
He's
45. I think he'll be 46 when the season starts. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, he's not just performing. He's not, like, hanging on. Right. Like Roethlisberger in his last year. Like, Roethlisberger was hanging on with his fingernails. But Brady, I mean, I think he had statistically one of his best years ever last year.
As an old man.
Yeah, well, he always took care of himself. Mm-hmm. And he's always got that chip on his shoulder because he was taken in the sixth round. And remember, he was a backup to Brian Griese at Michigan.
Right.
All right? Brian Griese's been in the broadcast booth for 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so you don't think, like, despite all of his success and, you know, and the life he leads now, which is glamorous, right? And he's married to a supermodel and he's got a wonderful family. That guy still has that fire inside of him, and he can't leave the game because he loves it so much, and he always feels he has to prove people wrong. I have a lot of respect for Tom Brady.
Yeah, in the arena and the Tuck Rule are two.
Yes.
ESPN Plus.
Yeah.
Endlessly entertaining. I admire him, but I think he waited. I think he waited.
John, we're going to give you one more minute here to maybe tell the voters one more time to vote for you. And, you know, I want to hear about that passion, the fire that we've seen in you during this 45-minute interview here. I really appreciate you coming in, supporting Ventura 4 and our podcast, and getting to our listeners. Can that fire that you showed in this office, you talked about with Tom Brady, can you put that ahead of your family, your time? Because I believe that this district attorney for the Ventura County needs to put everything else ahead and put the public first. Is that something that you think is realistic? And give me one more minute about why people should vote for you.
Well, I mean, I'm not trying to put, like, my job. You know, it is a job. I'm not trying to put that above my family.
Sure.
Family always comes first. But
go next level is what I should have said, I guess.
Go next level, yeah. I just feel like at this time in the history of this county, we really need solutions. We're so tired of electing the same person over and over again, whether they have a different name or not, and wondering why nothing changes. It's because they're all the same. Let's try something new. Let's try some guy who just loves prosecuting cases and serving the public, who's dedicated his life to serving the public, who's dedicated his career to serving crime victims. Let's put him in charge and see what he does. I promise you, if people do that, they won't be disappointed. Because the things I talk about are the things I believe in. Now, about 18 months ago, a former police chief came over to my office, and you know, came over to my home, and he was pretty straightforward. You know, he said, "I'm supporting Eric. I'm a friend of his. I'm going to be supporting him." But he came over to my house out of respect, and he asked me about my platform. I said, "My platform is going to be crime victims first, pro-law enforcement." He got this funny look on his face, and he said, "Well, you're not going to win with that. You're going to have to change that." And I said, "Look, maybe you're right. Maybe I'm not going to win with that. But I'm not running for DA just because it's cool or I'm trying to use it as a stepping stone for a higher office. I'm doing this because I believe in my message. I believe in what I'm doing. I believe that this is the path we need to take to really make this county better." And so if I'm going to do this, if I've made the decision to enter into the political realm, then I have to do it my way. And I have to do it under a platform that I believe in.
Well, Spence, really appreciate you putting your name in that hat, because I can putting someone's name on a ballot, as I did a few years back, it's not an easy thing to do, to put yourself to be subjected. And also, it's part of the process in the American freedom. So thank you so much for making this a race, and good luck.
Thank you.
And here we go. We're going to wrap it up on episode number 7, Ventura Forward, sharing those vibes again, the Stoke Spent. I had a good time. You?
Yeah, excellent information, and we look forward to our next podcast. Keep listening, folks.
Okay, let's go.